Ready, camera one. And we're live in 3, 2.
Listeners, what gets you up in the morning? Is it a good scheduled cry or a great cup of coffee? If the answer is coffee, I have good news for you because the future is here and you can now get the best coffee you've ever had delivered right to your door. I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf, for those of you who are perhaps already high-strung enough. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this excellent coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You will taste the difference. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And now, Sparkplug is offering a special deal to Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will take 10% off any size coffee order. The offer doesn't apply to gear, but it does apply to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. That code is TOP100PROJECT, all one word, and with the number 100. So what are you waiting for? The time's never been better to start making the best cup of coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
And we're out. Roll open.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi, movie fans. Thank you much for clicking that play button on the next 100 Project, the podcast that showers you with thoughts about movie classics. Our work is spoiler-ridden, so listener beware. I'm your pretty but vapid host with an epic case of flop sweat, Ryan Ellis. And here's my hard-working and oft-weepy co-host and wife, Bev.
That's me.
Thanks, doll. Bev doesn't weep that much. So the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture broadcast news. One of my favorites from the 80s. What's the best movie ever made about television news?
I mean, there's some good ones to choose from, but the answer seems super obvious.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Network.
Of course, yeah, it's Network.
Yeah. Well, I wondered if you might have some competition from a few that you like, and I was thinking of Ace in the Hole, which is one of your favorites.
That's a newspaper, not television news.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
No, my honorable mentions are The Insider, which you don't like, but that's a great movie about TV news. Good Night and Good Luck, you also don't like it, and that's an even better one about television news. The China Syndrome, which is about news in a way, more so on-location type stuff. And Nightcrawler, which is also about location shooting that becomes a news thing. But all four of those, including network and broadcast news, so six, I guess, are great movies about television. And we're both in television. Let's make that clear right now to those who don't know us very well. We're in television and have been, for me, almost 20 years. And for you, was it 10 or so?
I'm at 12 years this year. We can both attest to some things in broadcast news in particular that feel really authentic and accurate about what it's like to work in that kind of environment.
Hit pretty close to home. And I work specifically in news. You don't. But anyway, so let's move on and get into the next 100 Project's 87th movie, Broadcast News, which was absolutely nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. After some mid-December premieres, 20th Century Fox, we do that movie from them yet again this year. We've done so many Fox movies this year. Released it for everyone nearly 30 years ago on Christmas Day, 1987. Although not nearly the smash hit that James L. Brooks' previous hit Terms of Endearment had been, it was still a solid success. May I remind people what it's about with The Skinny?
Holly Hunter is Jane, a neurotic, super competent news producer, and Albert Brooks is her equally bright and devoted reporter and best friend Aaron. Enter William Hurt's Tom, a handsome, charismatic, yet inexperienced and uninformed newscaster who's hired to anchor the show. Jane must balance her outrage at this perceived injustice with her undeniable mutual attraction with Tom, an attraction that finally forces Aaron to admit to Jane that he's in love with her too. Can you wrap it up in a nutshell for us?
Well, there's this editor. One of my favorite scenes
in Shakespeare. That's me, guys. I'm an editor.
One of my favorite scenes in Shakespeare in Love is when you hear the guy in the background. What's this story about, Romeo and Juliet? Well, there's this nurse. So the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on broadcast news. 98% of critics like the movie, 42 fresh and only one rotten, but only 78% of audiences. The movie was 18th at the 1987 United States box office, and this is our last movie we're going to cover from 87, our fourth of the year. Three Men and a Baby was number one. We didn't cover that, but that was the number one hit of that year. We did cover Moonstruck, that was fifth. We did cover Princess Bride, that was 41st, and also Full Metal Jacket. I didn't mark down what that was, but they're the four movies we did this year. What'd you think of broadcast news?
I really like broadcast news, but it's never been one of my favorites. I'm not sure why exactly, because it has a superb script, incredible performances, refreshing and unique take on the romantic comedy, which is a genre that I always want to like more than I actually do. I wonder if it's just never gotten under my skin because of the ending. While it's really brave and it's definitely earned, it's just so disappointing.
Well, the movie knows enough not to force a happy ending, because Jane plus Tom equals nope.
Yeah, there's no way. But I root for her and Aaron so hard. But she just doesn't feel it. I guess she doesn't have that chemistry with Aaron.
He's in the friend zone.
But I will also say that I think the movie is making the argument very soundly that Jane isn't right for anybody. She is such a devoted workaholic. And actually, devoted is the wrong word. She's a pathological workaholic. Like, it's actually a problem. She is clearly a very anxious person. She has this troubled mind. The only way she can soothe it is by working all the time. And when she works, she doesn't just have to be busy. She has to have everything left to the last minute. They even show the scenes, and I've worked with people like this, and I'm sure that you have too. There are people who seem to almost intentionally leave things to the last minute because they live for that adrenaline rush.
You don't have time!
When it's 52 seconds to air. My favorite scene in this movie, and this probably isn't many people would share this opinion with me, where they have 52 seconds to air.
That's my favorite too.
Is your favorite too?
Bobby.
A, it is absolutely a fantastic scene. B, it's super realistic. Because I'm Bobby. I may not have ever worked in like network news like that, but I worked, whatever, we had deadlines. And it was a music news-oriented show, so we definitely had to deal with things as they came during the day. And I had producers that at the last minute, even though it was done and it could be in the can with a minute to spare, they would say, no, you know what? Do this one thing to make it a little bit better. And you can't argue that it makes it better, but you can argue that you are shortening my life, lady. It's fine as it is. If you wanted that, you should have thought of it 5 minutes ago, not 52 seconds to air. And it can be very frustrating. I know people like that. And I think that James L. Brooks does an excellent job of portraying what a really problematic workaholic looks like. And that a workaholic doesn't get cured by love. In fact, it almost seems like she actively chooses the wrong man. I mean, her and Aaron are like soulmates. They actually do belong together. They share the same sense of humor, the same intellect, and they respect and love each other so much.
But needy is not attractive.
Albert Brooks is not the world's most handsome man.
Mm-hmm.
I get that.
And when he gets rejected, he's kind of like Seinfeld when he does his comedy. The anger, I should say, in his comedy. They both have that sort of almost funny way of being angry. Brooks is different than Seinfeld in one big way. He can be ferocious and mean. And it's, get out of here! I want you to get out! He's almost as angry as anybody we've ever seen in the movies, like Brando at his best or something, in that one scene anyway.
With a different performer or with less adept writing, that would be the scene that would turn the audience against him and make them just actively root for Tom and think, well, clearly that's who she belongs with because he was mean all along. But the place where his mean words come from is this place of hurt that we can all relate to. I mean, what's worse than rejection? There's something about that that just cuts so much to the bone and can make you so angry. And when you see their relationship together, you can see how he could have believed he had a shot. Not to say that she led him on, but they just had such an easy nature with each other and there was already so much intimacy there. Just such a well-written and performed film for something that could easily be just like a light, dumb, fluffy comedy. But instead, there's this really believable depth to all these characters.
Something about Network, actually, as much as that's the better film. But this movie gets more into the relationships and the personalities of the three leads. And Network's three leads, or really more than three, but especially Holden, Dunaway, and Finch, they don't really spend that much time on screen together, any of them.
Well, Network is a satire, so it's not really trying to get into these people's heads.
Sidney Lumet always said, it's your reportage. You watch the special features or listen to the commentary, he says that line so many times.
Okay, but can you be sheer reportage and a satire at the same time? Because Network is a satire.
Oh, I agree.
I mean, come on. And the characters are all caricatures. In a great way. It's still like an incredibly smart written film. And the actors do a fabulous job. But we're not trying to really get behind what Faye Dunaway is thinking and feeling. That is definitely not the point.
We really don't learn that much about her, considering she was an Academy Award winner in that year. And it was a great performance. One of her best performances. We know Holden the best of those three. And he didn't win the Oscar, actually. It was Finch that won the Best Actor Oscar.
She didn't win, but the woman who played his wife.
Oh, sorry, she did. Yeah, Beatrice Straight won. And yeah, so did Dunaway.
5 minute scene, if basically. That, yeah.
Great scene for sure. But let's get back to broadcast news, because they're not competitors in the land of movies about TV, but they obviously can be compared, and we will do that again before the podcast is over, I'm sure. But after the initial scenes of the young Tom, we see him first, then the young Aaron, then the young Jane. In that order, we see those three characters. Some good establishing stuff of what they're going to be like as they're adults. Then we see Jane give her speech where she rails against where things are going in the news game, which is reminiscent of what happens in the beginning and then the end of Good Night and Good Luck, a movie that, like I say, you don't like that much, and you should, because it's great too.
I am wrong about this movie.
Jane reaches Tom, who's in the audience, of course, with her badly received speech. No one else wants to listen to it. And that's funny, but also a little bit bullshit. People don't walk out of speeches in those kinds of numbers. Maybe 10 people would, but not everybody in the audience except for him and his date.
And right off the top, she gets about 30 seconds in before people just start checking their watches and heading for the door. Where do you gotta be, people?
The lesson we get from that scene in the early part of the movie is, listen to me, and I'll fuck you. Tom's sincere. He wants to learn from her. He seems to actually like her off the bat, too. But if he wanted just into her pants, if that's all it was, he could have had that just by listening to her, because no one else did.
I disagree, because Aaron listens to her, and he can't get anywhere.
Well, he can, because he's Tom. He's William Hurt.
Yes, yeah, so it's not listen to me and you can get in my pants. It's be tall and handsome.
And also
have a
listen
cleft
to me.
Chin. He does have this really beautiful, natural charisma in this film. It's everything, just the grace of his movements, everything about him exudes what I think we both overvalue and undervalue in a certain type of person. He's not smart. He knows he's not smart. He could so easily be this vile character, this person who uses all the advantages that he was born with and believes that he earned them and, like, walks all over people because he can, because he's tall and white, male, handsome.
Blonde.
Everything. And because he has this charisma. But he's more aware.
The young Tom even knows that.
Yeah, he's born this insightful person and this kind of thoughtful person.
Self-aware.
Self-aware. So he may not be smart in the intellectual way, but he's far more self-aware than either Jane or Aaron are. And I think that the movie is making a case for perhaps people who have this particular talent, which is being handsome and looking good on television, deserve to be on television. And of course there's going to be someone in the background reading the lines directly.
He takes direction well. That's an important thing.
Yeah, and he can listen and talk at the same time. He's very good at his job. He works hard at being good at his job. He's not just lazy and entitled. Mm-hmm. And he gives credit to the people who help him look
including
good.
Including the editor.
On television. Yes, everybody. He does everything right. The fact is, when I'm at home watching the news or watching anything, I do want charismatic, good-looking people on television. Maybe it's not popular to admit that, but I think that whether we realize it or not, we all do prefer pleasant-looking things on our screen. And
Woody Allen
certainly charismatic people. And Woody Allen's not wrong. Although, of course, he casts himself in all of his movies. Yeah. It's not like he's
against
a
superstar-looking babes, usually.
Yeah.
Well, Tom doesn't fuck Jane that first night they're alone. He probably could have.
Oh, he definitely could
have. Or the second. Or the third. There's never any sex between any of the three. Obviously, the guys aren't going to have sex. Well, they could. Hey, let's be liberated. The guys could have had sex. Why not? And then Jane doesn't sleep with either of the two romantic leads in this rom-com that so often leads down that road. The only sex we ever see in the whole movie is Tom and Jennifer, and it's after the fact.
There's a line in the film after she's been speaking into his ear, and they have this really great, intense broadcast where they're really simpatico with one another, and he gets so excited by it, and he comes over to her desk, and he grabs her chair by the handles and overwhelms her with his enthusiasm, and he says, God, it was better than sex! Because I think that all three
like
of them
really sex,
like their jobs better than sex. They love that feeling better than an orgasm.
And I agree, and that scene is excellent. But it's also quaint for someone like me who's worked in live news, where we're live all the time. The notion that they're going to go live, and I think it's supposed to be a Sunday afternoon, and it's this whole big thing. Let's all leave this party, this big prep that takes what seems to be a long time. It's probably not that long, but long enough. When what I do, I'm the end product, but anyway, what I'm involved with, they just do that whenever they possibly can because they're live anyway. That's also 2017. I've been doing this since the late 90s, so it's even 10 years after this movie's set. But it's a little bit quaint and kind of funny to me that this whole big thing, oh my God, the big host, Jack Nicholson's character, is on the boat, so let's get somebody else and take all this prep time. How do we do this? How can we manage to pull this off? But I guess that was typical back for network news because they weren't on the air already. It was a soap opera probably all of Sunday, which would have been something else, actually.
Everybody would have the experience and not actually be that impressed by the whole thing, but it's Tom who's the newbie who is impressed and overwhelmed and has the potential to completely flop, fall on his face, and be embarrassed the way Aaron later is.
Oh, there's two moments in this movie I gotta talk about. Here's the first one. When Tom loses connection with Jane, the intercom doesn't work for a minute, and he doesn't know what to say, and he gives his opinion on something, pretty minor opinion for that matter. They cut to Robert Prosky, and he says, "Who cares what you think?" Amen, brother. I've been working in this game long enough to hear people editorialize way too often. And the CBC, for all of its faults, and I could go on about that for this whole podcast, for the most part seems to be relatively neutral. And we still have way too many people that will editorialize on air. And we all know that pundits on other stations, including the CBC, but certainly the American ones, have made a lot of money editorializing. And the people that host those shows are not being neutral, at least not neutral enough. So I love that moment of saying, this isn't your job to say what you think, although the guy had to say something because he lost connection with the voice in his ear. But that's a very important point as far as I'm concerned. Just like when Aaron later says, let's never forget, we're the real story, not them.
You're bringing up a great point. One of the movie's main themes is about how news is changing. Now, this movie was made in 87. Long before network news really took over and really changed things. And you talk about
cable news, actually. Let's be honest, cable news.
Yeah, you're right. That's what I meant to say. It was cable news. But you talk about things being quaint. Well, there's nothing more quaint than seeing a room full of journalists who really assume that everybody is going to have absolute journalistic ethics and that it would be embarrassing to admit that you care about ratings. As much as I say, hey, you know what the public wants? They want to see good-looking, charismatic people. The public obviously also wants to hear punditry. They want people to express their opinions. They want to obviously watch people who agree with them, which is why we have pretty partisan news networks. Not so much in Canada here, but obviously in the States, and we are keenly aware of what goes on in the States. But that is on air because that's what people want. And the movie's so much about Jane being in the old school and caring about the ethics of journalism and caring so much. They illustrate her several times caring about getting things right and not interfering with the story, not ever making herself part of the story, as
the
you say.
The moral quality.
Yes. I'm just here to tell the story, and I am not here to give an opinion at all. I'm just presenting information.
Like the scene when they're in South America, I guess it is, where you put on the boots wherever you want to, sir, and everyone waits, and he pulls his boots on like he was going to anyway. But that does play into what we've talked about a few times in our podcast about how even when you try to document something and not try to affect its outcome, especially with human beings, you're going to affect it. The minute there are people in a war zone shooting this with their camera who are trying not to be a part of the story, they're part of the story. Because for one thing, the military people might try to protect them from getting shot.
And people behave differently when they're on camera, period. Mm-hmm. People are going to tell a story differently when they're on camera than they would tell their friend, than they would tell their mother, that they would even tell themselves in their own head. And even that is different from whatever the version of the truth is. You can't have pure journalism. You can't actually just say pure facts. That's impossible. But there's no question that journalism has veered further and further away from being devoted to giving facts and more towards giving the people at home whatever they want. And as much as Jane protests when people do this, I have an argument that in the Bobby, 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 Bobby scene, the shot that she wants to put in is a shot of a painting, like a quaint, not a Norman Rockwell painting.
Rockwell-esque, though.
Rockwell-esque painting to juxtapose with the story that they're telling. That's editorializing. Right there. It is visual and it's not, I guess, so explicit. But what purpose is it to include an image like that? It improves the story and everybody gives her credit, claps her on the back and says, look how much that detail helped the story and now I'm feeling it. Well, if you're just trying to present the facts, then why are you trying to hit people in the heart? The crux of the story being on whether or not Tom fake cried during the story about date rape. Mm. Let's say he really cried and they really had two cameras on that shoot. Isn't it still editorializing to show your anchor breaking into tears? Why would you show him at all? Whether it really happened or it didn't.
Because they show the anchor in cutaways all the time.
Yeah, but isn't that editorializing? When you're just showing a reaction, when the only purpose of cutting back to him is to show a reaction.
To cover an edit, usually.
Okay.
Answer this question for people.
But you could choose any shot. Mm-hmm. And I do this all the time as an editor. If I'm choosing reaction shots, I don't give a damn if it's consistent, if it's in sync with what was really going on. Are you kidding? The cameraman could have been doing anything. I will take whatever reaction shot I deem appropriate in that moment, whether it happened then or not. But if you really wanted to remain neutral, you would only show neutral reactions when you're covering those edits. But showing him crying is editorializing.
And the rape victim is Nancy from Groundhog Day. Marita Garrati is how you say her name, I think, actually. That's a very important scene in the movie. Obviously, it's the crux of the movie in the end where Jane realizes he faked the story. And, of course, Aaron's the one who rats out Tom about that. And Tom even says, I thought it'd be okay because I almost cried the first time and everything. He should have realized Jane would have accepted that. But Roger Ebert, even though he liked this movie a lot, pointed out in his review that an experienced reporter, news person, I should say, like Jane, would realize there's something wrong with that. Although they do very smartly show early on, and somebody even says in the newsroom on one of Tom's other pieces, oh, Tom takes two cameras with him out on location because he's trying to corner somebody, a whole different story than the rape story. And then it cuts away to Tom's face, and you can tell it's right there live. It's not a matter of them cutting that later. So somebody here in a voiceover says, oh, he's got two cameras. So they establish that very smartly. But for a big twist, if you will, in this movie, it is kind of weak that Jane would have fallen for it in the first place, and that she'd be so strongly against it when she's ready to go on vacation with this guy after getting Robert Prosky's job as the boss of the whole local network.
I'm sure that when they fired him and hired her, they were probably paying her a quarter of what they were paying him.
They would have anyway, but especially being a woman.
Yeah, especially. Now, back to the more important stuff, which is, do you
You're right, though. That's very true. Whoever was picked for him would have been paid a lot less than he was because he was a very wealthy older guy. Obviously, he was in his 60s by the looks of Robert Prosky in late 80s. So whatever he was being paid, you're going to pay the next person a lot less. But a woman, probably even less than that. So you're not wrong in saying that. And that's not just a feminist angle on this. That's the simple truth.
And another thing this movie really gets right is what it's like to work in a place that is suffering massive layoffs.
I've been in a company that bitches about money since before I was fucking there. We can't afford anything. We can't afford anything. And constant cutbacks. But then every company that succeeds, including yours, which is doing very well, Bell is your owner, still cuts back stuff. And to a certain degree, I understand that because technology allows you to have fewer people doing what we do for a living.
Also, things change. You know, I used to work for a station that primarily played music videos, and then YouTube came and killed it. The fact is, our division was not making money. I ended up getting transferred somewhere else, but there was a day when close to 80% of the people I had worked with for close to a decade were laid off. People got displaced, they got moved somewhere else, but the company that, as far as I was concerned, had worked for 9 years was basically gone, and I was placed into a different job, and it was truly like a funeral, and you truly grieve. It's hard to explain if somebody hasn't been through it, but I think a lot of people have been through it. Probably a lot of people share this experience.
I certainly have been.
Yeah, and broadcast news gets it right. When you got a department like that, and we have a job like that especially, where there's so much pressure and people really feel like a family and they rely on each other like a family. I can't remember exactly how she words it. I think she says it's like a funeral or something, or it feels like somebody died, because to her, somebody died, something that she loved died. And yes, it's going to change, it's going to become something else, but it's almost like a family. If you lose a family member, you still have a family, but you have to grieve and get used to that change. I love the way they handled that moment with as much gravity as they did, and it was about so much more than whether or not she kept her job, and she got promoted even.
Just like Tom did.
Yeah. But I want to backtrack to, she was going to go on vacation with Tom. If she had not found out about that tape, do you think she would have gone on vacation with Tom? Whether it was subconscious or not, I think she's just dying for an excuse to sabotage that.
She intended to go. Maybe she wouldn't have actually gone through with it, but the movie seems to suggest that she was going to go until she saw that, no, he faked the story, pretended to cry. He didn't really pretend to cry. They even say about how he almost cried. He was welling up. Well, I could try again now. So is it honest? No, but Aaron and Jane, as much as I love them in this movie, are way too naive for television news. And I guess that's what the movie is suggesting. It's the mid-80s and going into the late 80s. You can't survive if you're going to be completely objective and you're going to be this journalist above everything else kind of idea. Tom is not really a liar, but he's also not fully honest because of that story. For example, Jane and Aaron are both a little too pie in the sky.
I would say that they're a little bit smug. It's not that they're naive, it's that they just really love the view from their high horse. She does these things in a milder way. She still wants to manipulate the viewer, but she cannot stand that somebody like Tom, who's not as smart as her, could also be good at this job.
But at the very end of the movie, she's going to be his editor-in-chief. So in the end, it took many years, but she's caving to be the voice in his ear and leading him through this. And that doesn't have to be a terrible thing, because not everybody can be both the on-air person and the guy who's actually in charge of all the news. Peter Mansbridge, who worked at the CBC forever, was the guy who was in charge of the news and was also the on-air personality. And I can say a lot about that guy, but I will never deny he was good at those things. I'm sure he was very intelligent and behind the scenes legitimately earned the job of being that guy. Tom doesn't, but what about a team? Why does it have to be that the guy who's on the air has to, or the woman for that matter, has to be the person that also is in charge of the whole thing? I'm the front man, or the front woman in some cases, but this other person, man or woman, is in my ear, and there's somebody else, and we're all a team to make this work. I don't have to be the only person with the ball sinking the three-pointers. We pass the ball around, and we all contribute to this thing.
And Aaron makes the great point after he spectacularly fails.
Flop sweat
that,
scene.
Yeah, it's not just that he's bad at anchoring the show. It's that he doesn't want to do it. He really likes being in the field. He really likes doing the things that he's good at. It's ambition that makes him think that he wants to anchor the show.
It also would have won Jane, I think, is what he's really thinking.
Yeah, I know. You may be right.
He's the fallback for Jane in the early part of the movie, after her big speech where everyone leaves and she could have fucked Tom and everything. She calls Aaron right away. She's not trying to fuck him, but he's in her ear, if you will, because he's on the phone. But in the flop sweat scene, or what follows it, I guess, when they're in his house later on, his apartment, she's supposed to go back and be with Tom, but she's with Aaron instead. So in some ways, he's her fallback again, but she's actually just checking in on him. And as he admits in that scene, I maybe wouldn't be saying any of these things if it had gone well for me tonight.
Hmm. Maybe he would have hoped he could have won her over. That's another way that she sabotaged her relationship with Tom, because she's got this great thing going on with him, and then she just says, oh no, Aaron needs me to like go make him feel better, and she's out the door. I read a quote from James L. Brooks. This movie is about three people's last best chance at intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
They all fail at the end. Now, of course, when we see the epilogue, both of the men have found love.
Regardless. And Jane does too. All three of them actually have.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She has a boyfriend, mm-hmm. doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they've all found love with someone else.
And they all seem content.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron has a son. By the way, Aaron, in the scene where Tom's on the air, and Aaron is passed over, it's probably the TSN turning point, if you will. TSN's Canadian. Where Aaron thinks he's going to be the host because Nicholson, Bill Rorsch, is on his boat, so you got to get somebody else. Why wouldn't it be Aaron? He's the next logical person. But when they pass him over, that's the turning point in the whole film. But then Aaron goes home and he's getting drunk and he's pissed off, but then he just can't stay away. I say it here, it comes out there. It's like he's lip-syncing for Tom. He's lip-syncing through Jane, through Tom.
But like you said...
But that's teamwork!
Exactly! Don't you just want to be doing the job that you're good at? You don't need the people at home in America to know. Most jobs, nobody knows outside of your team what you accomplished and what you did. I'm such an invisible player.
The average person doesn't know what you do at all.
No, exactly. Like, it's hard to describe. And even you, too. Like, the average people don't really know what we do. But, I don't know, that doesn't diminish it for me. My team knows what I do. They know how I help out. They know how I help create the show. The honor people, it's like notorious. There was an incident at our Christmas party where the honor people didn't even know who I was. The actual on-air talent, I don't even meet them. But I still feel very strongly like I'm a part of the show and I help make it happen. And I'm competent and I'm happy to be my little cog in this wheel. Maybe everybody should be, but this is a movie about ambitious people. And ambitious people are never going to be happy just doing what they're doing. They're always going to want more, more, more. Even if that's counter to what's going to give them a good life.
Well, before Aaron's flop sweat, you see him typing on his copy and prepping for the broadcast. I'll use my Marge Simpson voice here. They're all so supportive. Because that one guy says, that's great copy, Aaron. They're all so with him. It's really a nice moment. I don't witness that kind of stuff. I'm not in the newsroom, but I know quite a few people that are in the newsroom. I can buy that's the way it is for all those people even now. Not so much in my department. Not at all in my department. But that's followed up with Aaron's failure and then his whole, you go to hell, when Jane comes to his place later on. So it's supportive before he fails, then after he's failed, and it's his own fault. He's the one who sweated. No one's going to be blamed for that. But he's mad at Jane for daring to want to go off with the blonde guy.
How did they do the sweat thing?
Technically?
Yeah, technically. I mean, obviously there's cuts so you can, you know, they've just added sweat to his underarms and his hair and stuff. But there are points where there's just sweat trickling down.
It helps have the Criterion Blu-ray for that exact thing. Because you really can't miss that big giant drop of sweat coming down the forehead.
It looks like they must have had like a tube running through his hair. They might have, because it is like an overwhelming amount. But it's not like Airplane where it's just ridiculous looking. It's just enough where you can kind of believe that somebody might sweat like that.
I don't think the old DVD showed off nearly as well as this Criterion Blu-ray did.
It is hysterical. Like, what a great scene. We haven't probably complimented this movie enough for how funny it is.
It's a comedy.
The script is whip smart. There's so many great, great lines. It kind of reminded me of His Girl Friday, where you just mm-hmm. have this fast, smart script and these great actors just rat-a-tat-tatting at each other. One of my favorites is somebody says to Jane, oh, you must feel pretty good to always be the smartest person in the room. And her response right away, so deadpan, is, it's awful. And she's so serious. You're so sincere in that moment. There's so many great lines like that. And it's hysterical. That scene with the sweat, the centerpiece of the film. Like, it doesn't get better than
that. And it's based on a real CNN anchor that Albert Brooks saw sweating late one night. I think it was even on a weekend. Like, he's in there on a Saturday. Fewer people are going to see it, but then Albert Brooks has said he never saw that guy again. So it's based on reality.
In the script, it had just said Aaron blows it. They hadn't yet gotten specific about what he does to blow it, and that's when he saw this anchor.
But Brooks told Brooks that's what it had to be. He called him in the middle of the night and said, he's got a sweat on air. You talk about great lines in the movie. This isn't even delivered by one of the major characters in the whole film, but during the layoff sequence, when we see Nicholson come into the newsroom, when he's there and he says, oh, because they couldn't program Wednesday nights or something like that, you can make it a little less brutal by knocking a million or so off your salary. His response is to not really respond to that. And then also later on, another guy says to, I think it's that same guy who talks to Nicholson, anything I can do for you or something like that? Well, I certainly hope you'll die soon. And these lines are delivered by the main actors.
There's an off-camera line delivered by, I can't remember what the line is. It's something like, this is bullshit. Somebody's just mad and throwing their desk around.
That's apparently John Cusack.
It's John Cusack, yeah. Well, Joan Cusack is in the movie, so I guess they needed an extra to say one line. She's like, my brother's an actor too. I mean, I don't know. I'm making this story up.
She says to Jane, except for socially, you're my role model. Even socially, Jane's not that bad. That's one thing too, that's typical movie thing we said about good-looking people being on screen. Well, Jane's supposed to be great at everything except she's not actually attractive or good at social stuff, but she's still adorable as hell because she's Holly Hunter, because you got to cast somebody who's got looks or else she's probably not going to be in a movie of this type at all.
Before she did this in Raising Arizona in the same year, she did a lot of theater. She kind of seemed in Hollywood like she came out of nowhere, but she had been acting for a long time in theater since she was pretty young. But because she was so petite and she has this high-pitched voice, she says that Raising Arizona and Broadcast News were the first projects she ever did where she played an adult. When you do theater, you kind of need grown-up people to do things like children and teenagers, and she was always playing a child or a teenager until she did these movies. She was like, oh, it was intimidating. I had to play like a bona fide, competent grown-up for the first time.
And we covered the movie that won the Oscar for Best Actress this year, Cher in Moonstruck, which is a decent choice, maybe even a good choice. I've always thought this should have been the one that won. Holly Hunter in Broadcast News should have been the Oscar winner. She's great in this movie. She's funny. She's likable. She's smart. She's annoying in a lot of ways, as we say. But she's also great as an actress in the film. But her resume is wonderful because she did win the Oscar for The Piano, where she didn't speak. That's a fantastic performance. She was worthy that year, no doubt. Then in The Incredibles, she provided a voice. She's had this great long career. Deborah Winger was supposed to play Jane, and she was in the role until only a few days before, and she pulled out because she got pregnant. She'd been in James Earl Brooks' previous big hit, Terms of Endearment. They probably got lucky. Winger's great, but Hunter is probably the better choice. And I wish there had been, I guess there still could be, I can't think of an example where there has been, a Holly and Joan pairing, meaning Holly Hunter and Joan Cusack, because they have a lot of chemistry in their scenes together, including in the Bobby, 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 Bobby scene, where Joan Cusack has the punch to the whole thing, where she's running the tape, and that was probably even true then. It's certainly true in the modern era, where you would just run the tape from the edit suite. They would have that dialed up as a source, and you would just do that. It wouldn't be, you have to physically run the tape in there. But it's just for comedy, they do that.
I remember you pointed out they never cued the tape. Right. So they actually wouldn't have made it to air because they would have had to rewind it, get to the cue point.
Because Bobby doesn't re-cue it, of course.
No, no. I've had a production assistant standing in the door of my edit suite, hands out, ready to take the tape. And then that moment when you go, oops, because you just, I don't know, press the wrong button, it's going to cost you 5 seconds, and everybody freaks out. That has happened to me before.
It's almost a thriller, too, because in the background is Tom, and he's rooting for them, too. Go! And John Cusack runs out of the room. William Hurt had been in The Big Chill. Kiss of the Spider-Woman won him the Oscar, and then an Oscar nomination for History of Violence in 2005, not that long ago. And it is such a great technique, and I guess we've already made this point, that Tom is not actually coasting on his looks. He wants to be better than he really is. And you've got an intelligent actor who's also not Brad Pitt, I suppose. He's good looking, better looking than Albert Brooks or Jack Nicholson. But he's not the kind of actor who could have coasted on his looks to get in Hollywood either. He had to be talented in addition to being an attractive guy. And William Hurt in this era was. He was one of the greats in the 80s. He was nominated for an Oscar something like every year there for a while. 3 years in a row anyway.
And he does just exude an incredible screen presence and charisma.
And then Albert Brooks, who is the comedy guy of all of them. I mean, they're all funny, but he's the funniest one. He was in Taxi Driver, which we covered way back when. And of course, Finding Nemo. Both he and Holly Hunter did voice roles in very successful Pixar movies. And his own movies. He's been a director in so many of his own films. And he can be in his own movies and in this one, funny and mean. That cutting moment when he gets hurt, it's deep.
I think I'm having a midlife love for Albert Brooks. I always liked him, but I never got what the big deal is. And then, I don't know, lately, I finally saw Lost in America. I think that triggered something where now I just love him. I just think he's so funny and brilliant.
And that's one of his own movies.
Oh, God, it's so funny.
And by the way, there's a line Tom has at the end when they find out what's happening and everyone's being laid off except he and Jane are getting promoted. What do you do when your real life exceeds your dreams? And that's the movie star dilemma, because that applies to probably everybody in this movie and certainly the main leads. They couldn't possibly have ever dreamed they would be, well, maybe a hunter at this point, because she was still not really in the business the same way that her was a made man. Brooks had been a made man forever. James R. Brooks had been a made man. Nicholson obviously had been a made man. But that's a line that's kind of one of those art imitating life, life imitating art kind of lines.
But you're burying the best part, which is Aaron's response. What happens when life exceeds your dreams? Keep it to yourself!
And of course, Jack Nicholson is in the film, but he's not promoted and he was unpaid. He must love James Brooks because he's been in three of his movies. And Brooks has only made five or six as a director. And Nicholson, of course, had won the Oscar for Terms of Endearment a few years before this, and he won again in a Brooks film, As Good as It Gets. And Nicholson was in three movies in 87. He was in Ironweed, where he got a nomination for Best Actor, so he was up against Hurt. And of course, he was also in Witches of Eastwick with Cher and others.
You said he was in three of his movies, but he's in four of his movies. Because you're forgetting, intentionally, how do you know that piece of hot garbage that unfortunately rounded out James L. Brooks' directing career?
And so far, it's Nicholson's last movie, although he's supposed to be in the remake of Tony Erdman, where he'll play the cantankerous uncle. So let's hope he does end with something else other than that, because that was not a good movie, How Do You Know? It was a pretty bad movie, actually, for the talent involved. Witherspoon and Owen Wilson, Paul Rudd,
and Brooks.
And Brooks as the director, yeah. Writer, and probably producer. Christian Clemenson is the editor, Bobby, who was in Apollo 13 and a lot of other films, too. Lois Childs is Jennifer. She was a Bond girl in Moonraker, in fact. And I almost wish we'd seen more of her in this film. She is not Jane at all. She's better looking than Jane, but not that much better looking. She's taller, I suppose.
She's very sexy, though.
But she's also kind of likable.
Yes.
And she's supportive and she's cool. Nobody's really an asshole of their own entire news team. Maybe that's realistic.
Jane is the biggest asshole.
In a way,
she
is. Jane's
the one that censored Anchorage so she can scoop her man.
That's true. That's right.
Yeah.
And Robert Prosky was, 6 years later in Mrs. Doubtfire as Rob Williams' boss. He's been in a ton of films, of course. And he's good in this film with that great line, "Who cares what you think? Amen, brother." Oh, fucking amen. The last actor we got to mention, very brief performance by Mark Shaman, who plays the jingle writer. And now he's a big-time composer. But he wasn't a composer on this film at that point. So the writer, director, and producer was James L. Brooks, who had done Terms of Endearment, later did As Good as It Gets, and then we just mentioned How Do You Know. He won every Oscar he could for Terms, and it was a number one hit. That was the biggest hit of the year. No, sorry, that was not true. Return of the Jedi was, but it was the second biggest hit. But then 4 years later, a good success, not quite as good a success, but of the two movies, to me, Broadcast News is way better.
He has a big TV career, too. He was behind
That's right.
Mary
we should have
Tyler
mentioned that
Moore
way back
show,
when.
Yeah.
Taxi.
And Taxi. And, of course,
The Simpsons.
Yeah, one of the co-creators of The Simpsons.
Which maybe wouldn't exist if he wasn't an executive producer. He was really involved in the early days of The Simpsons. I don't think he really has been that involved ever since. I know he was involved big time in the movie, more so than he'd been involved in the series in a while. But he was always a shepherd for them. But then Matt Groening's not really that involved in the series anymore either. Hasn't been for a long time.
He's just cashing checks.
So what do you think of his direction? We've done two of his movies this year, Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News.
I think he's a good director. I think he doesn't push my buttons. Most of his films I find just like a little bit too sentimental.
Maybe Terms has a better ending because you've got a girl who gets cancer and then dies. That's where that movie has to go. And then there's reconciliation at the end and some hope. And this movie's all about, where do we go with this whole thing? Let's have a layoff. Okay, that's realistic. That would have happened in the 80s. It happens now. But then, oh shit, I can't fuck this guy because he faked a story and I probably should have realized that in the first place. And then let's cut to many years later, which is a nice little denouement. But yeah, it's a little bit of a peter out more than it is actually an effective ending.
I don't love the denouement. I could have done without it. I find it a little bit strange. I think that they should have just ended it where they ended it.
And Roger Ebert would be with you on the ending of As Good As It Gets. He didn't buy that Nicholson and Helen Hunt would be together. And I've seen that movie more and more, I love As Good As It Gets. I'm with them too. I think he's right. They don't belong together. And the movie is not suggesting they're going to stay together. Mm-hmm. But at the end, it's forcing them together in a way that they shouldn't be, even temporarily.
Every time I think of James L. Brooks as a director, honestly, the first thing I think of is that cringe-inducing kiss. Both of them, where he's like, I can do better. And then he kisses her again. You're like, no, I still want to crawl out of my skin. Make it end. You're ruining the movie. There's something so tone-deaf about that moment. I don't know how to put it together, but there's just something about his films in particular that always miss the mark for me. I can sit here and I can compliment all these individual things about Broadcast News. The script is incredible. It's so funny. The performances are amazing. There's so much to like about it. It's funny and lighthearted, but smart at the same time. But at the end of the day, I cannot tell you when I'll ever put this movie in the player again just to voluntarily watch it. Where do you stand on it? I know you like it a lot.
It's my favorite of his films. As Good As It Gets is the one I've seen the most, and it's maybe the most likable.
Well, you love Jack Nicholson, so.
I do. I said at the top of the podcast, I think this is one of the better films of the 80s. It's not the film I'm going to watch the most in the 80s. It'd be the Back to the Future series or one of the more Take Me Back to My Childhood kind of deals. Maybe even Top Gun, which takes me back to my childhood. One of the smarter adult films, and certainly between this and Terms of Endearment from him, or, I don't know, Out of Africa or one of those kinds of films. I'm going to watch this any day. But it also does apply more to me than most people, even more than it does to you, because I specifically work in this industry. I don't work in the newsroom, and never did, but I've been in the newsroom, and I certainly have worked with those people. And indirectly, I still do now, because I've always worked for television news at CBC News Network.
Mm-hmm.
So we watched the 1.85:1 Criterion Blu-ray, and it looked pretty damn good. You can see the sweat from Aaron so crystal clear dripping off his face. Is this noticeable? It reminds me of Carla and Cheers saying about Norm sweating. We could grow rice. The cinematographer was Michael Bauhaus, who worked so much with Scorsese. I guess still does work with Scorsese. Goodfellas and The Departed. And then Richie Marx, the editor. So maybe the movie should have been cut down. If you're saying you didn't like some of the things in the film, I guess you could have argued it should have been cut down. But he worked with Coppola on The Godfather Part II, Apocalypse Now, and then was also a Brooks guy. Do you think the movie should have been cut down and made shorter?
I would drop the Jennifer subplot and drop the epilogue.
Have Jane by herself in a cab giving a guy directions. And kudos to her for being so specific. I don't do that, but I can certainly understand why she would be that way.
She reminded me as a character of Sally in When Harry Met Sally. Like, very similar in the way that you have somebody who's adorable and lovable, but whose personality sabotages their success in life socially, whether it be love or friendships or anything. But they just cannot help being that way. She tries to stop herself. She's like, take any way you want. But the bell weighs faster.
It seems like that and the one in When Harry Met Sally, when she wants the food specifically, that kind of turned me on more than the other scenes do. Kudos to them.
You know, you love these characters who are just so much themselves. And we all know people like that. And we can still love people like that.
But specificity is very important. If you can be specific, then do so. And here's something you haven't liked much in our podcast. The music. Bill Conti, who of course did the score in Rocky and won an Oscar for The Right Stuff the same year as Terms of Endearment was out. The music's not a big part of this film. It's not even Mark Shaiman, who is in the movie as the jingle writer, but what do you think of Bill Conti's music?
I am not a fan. I was not a fan of the score in Terms of Endearment. I just don't like the way James L. Brooks leaves his music. It's very sentimental. It's very TV. It's really TV.
And it makes sense. He came
yeah.
from TV. It's impressive he succeeded as much as he has because he is a TV guy first and foremost. And we see so many people like Vince Gilligan, who's been involved in TV for so long, hasn't really gone into the movies ever since. He went from Breaking Bad into Better Call Saul. Maybe he knows that's where he should stay.
Maybe like Aaron, he just knows what his strengths
found
are.
His niche. Yeah.
And decided to play to his strengths. If this is something that a good professional spot for you, then stay there.
And kudos to Aaron for taking a stand and quitting rather than taking less money but staying with the same company because he's saying basically, no, fuck you. And maybe he won't do better, but he has his principles. This movie is all about that. For those two characters, at least, Aaron and Jane, our standards are so high. And then sometimes they will compromise.
And maybe he needed to walk away from Washington. Maybe he needed an excuse to do it, to walk away from Jane, walk away from this high-pressure job, go to Portland.
And have Clifford.
Yeah, they don't really dig that deep into it. So
that's right. The movie was nominated for 7 Oscars. It won none of them. Best Picture, Best Actor for Hurt, Best Actress for Hunter. Should have won that one. Supporting Actor for Brooks, who lost to Sean Connery. The screenplay, the cinematography, and the editing, which maybe wasn't a very good nomination. The movie's 64th on the top 100 laughs. I think that's appropriate. It belongs on the laughs somewhere. Some Like It Hot was number one. And it was nominated for the top 100 quotes with, I'll meet you at the place near the thing where we went that time. But there's so many of the quotes from the screenplay you could have nominated as well. How about the passions? Why wasn't it one of the top 400 passions nominees?
Because they're real passionates for their job.
But that's fine. Doesn't have to be about romantic passion, but there's also romantic passion. Tom and Jane and Aaron all share that in some way or another. Yes, it's more about their jobs, it's true, but they're very passionate people. All right, then last thoughts on broadcast news.
I'm just disappointed I can't get into it more.
But a thumb up at least,
but
right?
But a thumb up, absolutely essential viewing.
And you recommend this to people who have never seen it, especially people in your business, our business?
Totally. It's a really easy recommendation. I can't imagine anybody regretting watching it, and there's so much value in it.
Well, I already said more than once I love the movie, but I will acknowledge it does have some flaws. The acting and the direction, mostly the direction, and certainly the screenplay, are the main reasons why. And it's damn funny, let's not forget that. So, when we return on the 18th of December, we'll fa-la-la it up with a Christmas movie. The 70-year-old holiday classic, Miracle on 34th Street. So yes, the 1947 version, not the 1994 version. The coming attraction trivia for Miracle on 34th Street. It won Oscars on 3 of its 4 nominations, with its only loss coming in the Best Picture category. Name at least 2 other movies that won Oscars for every nomination it had, except Best Picture. Got you back to digging for stuff, don't I? No opinions, which we've had a lot of lately.
Well, it could be easy if they were only nominated for, like, one award and it was costume
design. I said at least 2. There are 2 major ones, and they're fairly recent, mm-hmm. within the last, say, 30 or 40 years. Don't go back into the 40s. I'm sure there's probably 10 that fit this criteria that were nominated for something in 1942. I'm talking about more recent, but if you can find other ones, fine.
Okay. God, you're so mean. So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Miracle on 34th Street. Please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, you can check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 225-ish movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's one word, TOP100PROJECT, not case sensitive.
Big finish! Dun-dun-dun!
And cut.